Welcome to episode 17 of The Coriolis Effect. We know the secrets of the void. I'm Matthew.
And I'm Dave. And we've got a action-packed episode as usual for you today. We have a world of gaming coming up with a lot of stuff to talk about, actually. A lot of Kickstarters and some other bits and bobs. And then Matthew is going to talk about Reputation.
I don't like Reputation.
No, well, you can tell us why, and then we can have a talk about how we make it a bit better. The discussion point this week is the Nomad Federation. So really interested to hear what Matthew has to say about that. And then following
that... So you're hoping I've done my homework then?
You better have done your homework, because I did so much homework last time that, the bar is set very high, Matt, so you better have done well.
Right, yeah, I'm ready. I'm not gonna compete with your trade, but I've got a lot to talk about with the Nomads.
Excellent. Following that, we'll have a follow-on essay from you, following on Reputation, about Oases, which I think is going to be really interesting. And I have a Spectral Corsair update to round off the program. And I think that's about it for today, but we've got quite a lot to talk about in those five or six different topics.
So we better get stuck in.
We better
do. Of course, in the world of gaming, the biggest news is the current Kickstarter, which I'm sure will still be current when we drop this into your podcatchers. And that's Free Elegans' Emissary Lost.
Emissary
campaign.
Lost. Yeah, absolutely. I just saw today that we've just passed 1,000 backers, which I thought was really good.
I saw earlier on today that we passed 1,001 backers, which, of course, 1,001 nights seems particularly appropriate.
Potentially. It's funny, I also, for the first time, I watched the video trailer for Emissary Lost today. And as the music started, I was going, that's really familiar. Where have I heard that before? And it's obviously the music we used to open the bloody podcast, isn't it? Duh. Anyway.
Yes, it is. But they didn't steal it from us. We stole it from them. Well, we didn't steal it from them. We asked their permission. So that's good.
We asked kindly and they said yes.
I've got to admit, I backed in haste. I was at work when it dropped and I'd set myself a little reminder, but I knew I was going to be in a meeting. And so that meeting overran a little bit. It should have finished actually pretty much at the time when it dropped. But when I then looked at my phone as we were moving on to another part of the building where I worked, I could see it had dropped. A little reminder came up and I just went straight to the website and backed, thinking I'll read it all later. And eventually I did read it. But
what
I
did you do?
Looked at the video. Is the video good?
Oh yeah, it's all right. It's not the same quality as some of their Mutant Year Zero videos, which are absolutely fabulous. It's just pretty much still artwork with some text over the top with good music. So it's fine, but it's what they need to do is do some trailers like the Year Zero ones, because those Year Zero ones are absolutely fabulous. I mean, the one I like the most, just to digress slightly, was you have for Mutant Year Zero, you have your character walking through the zone and looking really cool with all his, sort of outfit. And he finds this arc and he's looking at it and you see a reflection in his goggles of a flash of light. And it's a sniper on the arc shooting at him and it hits him and he falls down dead. It's just a great, great video. People haven't watched it, go and find it. It's absolutely brilliant.
Manages expectations in terms of playing that game.
It does. Yeah. It was really cool.
Well, I've just noticed, actually, that Free Elegan have put out an update on the Emissary Lost campaign, and they, too, spotted that we were 1,001 backers. Although, as they write, it's 1,010.
Yeah, that's what I saw, yeah.
So they're they're very chuffed with that.
Well, not surprising. One of the interesting things that I saw is... one of the stretch goals, the Algebra of the Icons scenario, looks really interesting. So it's a murder mystery scenario, which obviously we don't know very much about it other than the little bit of text they've chucked out so far. But it immediately made me think of the robot books with Elijah Bailey, written by Isaac Asimov, with Elijah Bailey being the detective who's called in to...
The Three Laws of Robotics.
Yeah, exactly. He's called in to investigate murders that look like they could only have been caused by robots. And it's all about how the three laws are kind of circumvented or not, as the case may be. But it really reminded me of those, just looking at it and just... that's a good association, because those books are great.
I love those books.
I love those books.
They were some of my earliest sci-fi.
Yeah, well, likewise. You know,
beyond sort of juvenilia sci-fi. Which... So that's good. Now, tell me, Dave, what level did you back at?
Oof, what was it called? I backed at... Oh, let me have a look. Was it... I can't remember what
you
the
want
name...
those dice, don't you?
I want the dice, yes.
So you've backed at ambassador level, haven't you?
Is that what it's called, ambassador? That might be
I think ambassador levels, that gets the book. Oh. It gets any of the printed stuff. It gets all the electronic stuff, of course. It gets the dice.
I backed ambassador, you're right, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now,
what did you back?
That's a really sensible thing to have done. I haven't done the sensible thing.
You normally are very sensible, though. So yeah, I think you've had a rush of blood to the head, haven't you, with this?
Well, I was doing it in a rush, as I say. I backed quickly, and I thought, well, I haven't got time to read what, you know, comes with all the levels, so I'll just back the expensive level, and then I'll review my decision-making later on. So currently, I'm backed at Icon level.
And that's how much?
And that is, well, does it sound better in Swedish or English? I'm not entirely sure.
Don't think it sounds great in either, actually.
in krona, it's a mere 1,800 krona. No, it sounds awful in krona.
Yeah, that's about 180
in pounds,
quid.
On the other hand, it's entirely different. In pounds, it's, well, it says here 157, but I don't think our exchange rate is going to be that kind to me.
No, I think it is, because the pound has nosedived since Brexit came out. So it's a lot weaker against the krona than it has been. So that's probably about
that's,
right. Yeah.
You know, 170 something. I'm really torn. I backed it thinking I'd read it later and I could always, you know, change my pledge. But I haven't changed my pledge yet. And I haven't changed my pledge because I love that artwork.
Well, you do realise, now that you've announced on the podcast your level of backing, if you do reduce it, then you're just going to insult Costa and Nils and Ricard and Thomas. So you have to stick with it now. You can't change it.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I want to stick with it because I want to get... the thing you get for that level is you get a limited edition version of the book, which actually I might come back to that. I have some thoughts on that. But you also get a exclusive high quality canvas print, 50 by 70 centimeters of your choice of art by Martin Gripp, and I got five things there.
That might be worth doing actually. How long is left on the Kickstarter?
Well, they've got the Martin Gripp cover piece with a beautiful golden lady holding holding Coriolis in her palms.
Yeah,
I really, really want that.
That's nice, isn't it?
But that actually brings me back to the book. I'm not that fussed with the limited edition cover.
Okay.
In fact, I think I kind of prefer the basic cover.
Mm.
I don't know. But I tell you what, I have a thought here. There are 25 of these Icon level backers. I don't know when it sold out, but it obviously sold out pretty quickly because they say sold out now.
Oh, is Icon level sold out already, is it?
Yes.
Ah, okay.
So if I decide, or rather my wallet or my wife listens to this and decides for me.
The one advantage that our families and our wives don't listen to our podcasts is you can say what we like knowing that we don't get any comeback.
Yeah, but my boy sometimes listens to podcasts. Yeah, and what says he listens to this one?
Mine don't. I'm quite safe. I mean, so some of the money I've spent on some Kickstarters, you know, Jenny will never know about, which is great.
Yes, and we never need to tell her.
No, it's just between you and me and all our listeners.
Yes. And they won't read a word.
I was going to say, and the rest of the English-speaking world, but then that'll also have to be the Swedish-speaking world as well.
Yeah, we've got a lot of international listeners.
So shush, please, guys. Don't tell anyone. Shh.
But my thought is that if I am struck by sudden good sense and reduce my pledge to the very good value ambassador pledge, which I recommend to everybody. If I have to reduce it, though, I think there could be a bit of demand. I think there are some people out there wanting to get the deluxe version of the book.
Quite possibly,
got the limited edition cover of the core book, which I didn't go for, then they might want a matching cover of this campaign. And so this might be a hot property. So I was thinking that if I do, I might make an announcement on Twitter or in the forums beforehand and say, if you spread the word about our podcast, I'll put you in a raffle, pick a name out of a hat, and then I will liaise with you about exactly when
that's
I
a good
pledge so that somebody could be there to grab it. What do you think to that idea?
I think that's a really interesting twist on the whole Kickstarter thing. So now, I guess it might set a bad precedent because people then buy up all the Kickstarters and then auction them off. But it's a bit like...
their podcast.
It's a bit like ticket touting, isn't it? But be the first to do it. Why not? That sounds like a great idea.
Well, the problem is now Nils and Thomas and everybody from Fear League are going to hear this. We might get a cease and desist order from them.
We might. Well,
let's see what happens now we've said it.
Although,
Do we want to talk more about MSV Lost Stage?
No, I'm just going to say what it might do is encourage Nils and the guys to make more slots available at that level, possibly, if there's a demand. I don't know if they can do that in the terms
of
Kickstarter.
They did something like that with the core book offer, didn't they?
Yeah.
They released another version, limited edition, and I think they also released 100 more for UK buyers because they've got something wrong in the UK pricing or something.
So I think there might be options there. So they might listen to this, and rather than cease and desist us, they might just say, well, crack on, Matt, but screw you, because we're just going to offer 10 or 20 more slots anyway.
They may do that too.
But I don't think we need to worry about the Free League guys endorsing and supporting our podcast. I think we've cracked that one, I'm pleased to say.
Cool, yeah, they endorse it. I put a link in the column, in the comments, I should say, to episode 14, where... they were talking about the campaign with us and said, you know, if you want to find out more, you might want to listen to this.
Yes.
And they very kindly put another comment in saying, oh, yes, everybody should listen to the Coriolis Affair, which obviously everybody should. Tell all your friends.
Indeed, yeah. Yes. So now that's probably enough on Emissary Lost. But I think there's we can connect through, though, quite a nice little segue onto the Mutant Year Zero Road to Eden, although it's not a Kickstarter, but a couple of weeks ago, Funcom, which I think are the distributors, put out information around a computer game coming out, which is based on Mutant Year Zero. And I had a brief chat with Nils and learned a few bits and bobs, but not a great deal, because Free League aren't heavily involved in the creation and production of the game. They've obviously offered some creative insight, and it's based on Mutant Year Zero, so clearly they have an equity there. But the game is pretty much being developed by a company based in Malmö called the Bearded Ladies, and it's a single player XCOM like role playing game for the computer, which is going to be excellent. My wife saw it and she went, oh, you're going to buy that, aren't you? So yeah, I think I'm going to buy that one. Yeah, that's.
But surely she's going to play it. She's a bit of a gamer, isn't she? In the computer world,
she used to be. Not so much anymore. She's kind of fallen out of gaming over the last few years.
Has she?
Probably mostly down to the fact that she's got a kind of a career now, and she's working very hard in her job. So she finds that when she gets home of an evening, she doesn't really have much energy for computer gaming anymore. Which is fine, up to her, of course. But yeah, so I just wanted to put a flag out around about that, which I thought it's a really nice, interesting sort of development of the Mutant Year Zero franchise into what might be a much bigger market, and then that might draw people into the tabletop gaming realm as well.
Into the Mutant brand.
Exactly. And there's
lots of other exciting stuff that Freya Lagan are doing in terms of tying together the whole Mutant brand and stuff. They've made a couple of announcements on Facebook recently. So first of all, we've got Mutant Ad Astra, which seems to be Adventures with Space Monkeys, according to the illustration. There's a monkey in a spacesuit making a spacewalk outside a space station. So I think this is Orbital Mutant. And it reminds me of an old Cyberpunk 2020 expansion called Near Orbit. Do you remember that one?
I do. I've got it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. That's quite good. I that's one of the best expansions that game ever had.
It was really good. I think my... again, digressing onto Cyberpunk a little bit. As the GM running Cyberpunk, as I did for our group quite a bit, I always found the translating it into orbit much harder to keep the sort of look and feel that I loved about Cyberpunk, of the kind of gritty, wet streets element. So I love the idea that I tried to do that, but for me, it never really took that Cyberpunk grunge with it into orbit, I didn't think.
Well, no, I think you're right. You can't be that grungy in orbit, despite what they try and do in Alien and if you've got vehicles regularly going back and forth, they will get a bit dirty. But the environment up there itself is going to be, I don't know, yeah, not cyberpunky. But,
no.
But actually, I kind of liked Near Orbit because it was almost a game in itself, just running concurrently with what was going down in the dirty, wet streets on Earth.
Yeah.
So, and there were some nice ideas there about people with monkey-like physiology, finding it quite easy to operate in zero-G.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
So there's that. But, I think that's going to come out in Swedish and English at some point. But there's also Mutant Hindenburg.
Yeah.
And now, that was announced on their Facebook page, but in Swedish. Facebook did a bang-up job of translating it, but I'm still not entirely sure I understand what's going on with it. What's your take?
No, I'm in the same boat as you. I don't really understand what's going on here. As you said, the Swedish is, even though I know a little bit, it's still quite difficult to penetrate. But the one thing it does seem to be trying to do is drawing together that whole breadth of Mutant Year Zero franchise and bring it all into one canon, effectively, which I think is a really, really nice idea. Also, going back to, I think it was Mutant Heirs of Doom, which is one of the original ones. So trying to draw that into the Mutant canon as well, bringing it all together, which is great, because as far as I've been aware, the sort of Mutant Heirs of Doom early Mutant games and the Mutant Year Zero franchise, whilst sort of loosely associated, were different games and different settings. Not having played Heirs of Doom, so I might be talking completely out of my backside here, but that was my sense. And now you've got a game that's trying...
Please feel free to correct us.
Yeah, absolutely. But with this Mutant Hindenburg bringing everything under one banner, that sounds like a really good thing. If it helps players like me get into some of that early Mutant, which I haven't done so far, that'd be a really good thing.
Yeah. And of course, will it tie up with Modiphius's Mutant games?
I don't know. I don't get that sense.
That might just be a stretch too far.
Yeah. I could be wrong, but I don't get a sense that it's going to tie into the Mutant Chronicles that Modiphius puts out. Yeah. Be interesting to see. Absolutely. Talking of Kickstarters, I received my PDF of Mutant Mechatron the other day. They haven't got the full hard copy book yet, but I've got Mutant Mechatron in PDF. And again, you know, we've talked before about Golden Age of Gaming, and this really is. And I just need more time. There isn't enough time in the day to play
so
all
many
the...
games, so little time.
It's true. It really is true. I mean, just looking down at the list of the stuff that we're talking about on Kickstarter here. We've also got Western, which you know, I'm really excited about and waiting to play. I don't know what the planned delivery date for that is yet, but...
I'm being very relaxed about Western, given their
me too.
Health issues.
Oh, completely, yeah.
I'm sure it will come, but I'm not worrying. As you say, we've got so much to play.
Yeah.
It's not like I'm gagging for something else to distract me.
And again, I think with Kickstarters, I've always taken the philosophy that, you know, you back it, you pledge for it, you pay your money, and the game will arrive one day, eventually.
Or not. I always think that, you know, what I'm doing here is I like the thing, I want to make it happen. If for various reasons it doesn't, then that's the risk I took in backing it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I've been lucky enough so far. I've been lucky enough so far not to have that position. But as you say, as a gamer myself, I want to support people like me who are trying to produce, you know, great new games that I'm going to want to play. Because one day, you never know, I might be in that boat. I might be on Kickstarter trying to do something, and I would like other gamers to then, you know, help me with the chance to do stuff. So I think it's as you say, it's not like a go into a shop and make a transaction. It is a different beast. And I think as long as you recognise it as such and are content with the weight and the risk, then it's great. I'm loving it. I mean, I keep kickstarting stuff. I can't stop myself. So,
This might be a problem.
eventually it will be. The bank man will come knocking.
You told me about a board game that you've kickstarted?
Yeah. Now, this was a Kickstarter that I did late one evening after I'd had a couple of beers too many.
I'd suggest that's not the time to look at Kickstarter.
That's not, but I don't regret having kickstarted it. So the game's called Nemesis. And it's done by a company called Awaken Realms. And the game is effectively Alien, where you play a crew member on board a ship. And it's the board is a board that you build. It's got different tiles and you build your ship different every game, I think. And it's a survival game. You've got to survive the xenomorph that is on your ship and is going to be reproducing. And it just looked great, and the production values looked really good, and I was a bit drunk, and so I went for it, and I don't regret having gone for it. I think when it arrives, it's going to be the kind of board game that I absolutely love, so I'm really looking forward to seeing that one come through the door. I don't know what the delivery date for that one is, but it was a bit of a punt, but we'll see. Hopefully it's going to be a good punt.
I'm little nervous about board games. I bought, not kickstarted, but I did pre-order Firefly Adventures Brigands and Browncoats a few months ago, and I tried to play it last night, and the instructions for it are dreadful.
Yeah.
You know, we had three cleverly gaming minds trying to work out what was going on, and there was nothing like an introductory adventure and stuff.
That's a really common thing with a lot of games, that the rules, the quality of rule writing for board games is shocking, actually. You have to go on YouTube and watch a demonstration to get any sense.
Yeah, that's what we decided we'd have to do. And, you know, that shouldn't be required.
No, it shouldn't be, because, I mean, the rules should be really straightforward. One of my favourite board games is Star Wars Rebellion. And it's a brilliant, brilliant game, two-player game, but the rules for it are awful, and they contradict themselves. And I played it a lot now, so me and my boys, who I play with, or with whom I play. if anybody doesn't get that reference, go and listen to Tales from the Loop episode 1. Actual play. I think it's episode 1.
Yes, I think
1.
It is episode 1.
And it all will become clear. But
clearer.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. As clear as it might ever get when we're in the room, perhaps.
Yeah.
But we played it a lot, and we've finally worked out, I think, what the rules are. I mean, I think we've house ruled a few bits and bobs as well that seem to work. But you shouldn't have to do that. You should have a really clear explanation. So, yeah. That's a bit of a a bit of a digression. The last thing
it is a digression. I just realised we've missed out another delivery that you've taken, or no, I think you've got a delivery date for a Simbaroom Kickstarter.
Yep, so the Monster Codex, they've put out the delivery dates, so April in Sweden and June in the UK. So I look forward to receiving my Monster Codex and all my other bits and bobs from the Kickstarter in the next, where are we now? March, the next 2 or 3 months. That'd be great. Cool. Really looking forward to that. They're also about to do another Kickstarter, which is going to probably start next month, which will be to turn their Yinderos campaign, produce an English version of that. So that's something else that I'll keep an eye on and we'll probably back when it comes up next month, I think, if they stick to their to what they've said so far.
Excellent. Cool. Really good. I guess we also just add another item into our agenda. Did you get to have a look at the 3 chapters of Background from Forbidden Lands?
I haven't read it yet. No. Have you?
Yeah, it's a tough old read.
Is it? Okay.
So it starts off with a history, which is very chronological, and that's not the way I like to read my history. You know, it's this happened and then this happened and then this happened and then this happened. I'm more interested in discovering history through place, which is kind of why I was able to read the Coriolis book, because it kind of that, you know, the history emerges there from reading about all the places that there are in the Third Horizon. So this was frankly a bit of a dull read, but there's some interesting stuff about the races. Yeah, I'm sure it's not as dull as it's meant to be. And what I like about it is there is a mythology, and you know, the history itself is a mythology. It says this is what you understand to be true, but it might not actually, you know, be the way it all happened. So our elves are effectively powered by rubies that come from a comet. Humans arrived on this continent after a 3-generation-long voyage across the sea behind a raven carrying a snake. And is the god the raven or is the god the snake? Who can tell? Let's have a religious war over it. And there's some other gods. There's Rust and Heme as well, which I really like. So there's a good religious structure there, and there's a mythology. It's a mythology that makes me think of Glorantha, without being quite so exclusive. I find Glorantha is a really difficult mythology to get into.
I've never read that one.
You know, that's from RuneQuest and and stuff.
I've played
that.
It, but I've never really got into the background of it.
Yeah, and it's kind of tough to get into it. And of course, with, you know, that's one of the oldest mythologies out there. What's it, 50 years old or something now? And so 50 years of fans making shit up and and adding to it, I feel it can be quite off-putting. Whereas here we are at the beginning of a new world and a new mythology that we could all get into. So that's good. As I say, it was a bit of a slog actually reading it. So maybe only when you've got time.
Okay, well, I will. I mean, is there a lot of it then?
There's 3 chapters. Chapters. So there's some really interesting stuff about the races. And as I say, it's the first chapter being a chronology is the one that I find really quite wearing.
Right. Okay, well, I'll have a read of that before the next podcast. And I could give you my take on it. See what I think, whether I think you're being, needlessly harsh.
Fair or unfair.
Yeah. Yes.
Go ahead.
I'm never
needlessly critical. When I tell you you're wrong, Dave, you're wrong. As we will discover. Let's move on to...
But talking of fair or unfair, I just wanted to round off our World of Gaming thing, but kind of put right something that I said a few episodes ago about Star Trek Adventures. On your advice, in fact, on your insistence, I've been watching Star Trek The Next Generation. So I've watched the first season, just started the second. And
did I insist you watch The Next Generation?
Yeah, you kind of did. Yeah.
Okay, I'll believe you. It's the best.
Well, that's how it felt anyway. And I'm loving it, actually. It's a lot better than I expected it to be. I mean, there are some episodes that are toe-curlingly embarrassing.
Wait till you get onto season 7. God, there's some dreadful ones there.
Particularly, I don't know what it is. If I'm sat on the train watching an episode and the Ferengi are in it, I want to turn it off because I just feel embarrassed that somebody's going to look over my shoulder and see that I'm watching a program with Ferengi in it. It's just awful.
And they're not even the good Ferengi. I mean,
no, the
Ferengi
rubbish.
On Deep Space Nine are actually quite well-rounded characters, but the ones in...
Yeah, you're right.
The Ferengi episodes aren't much cop.
But I've really enjoyed it.
They pale into insignificance with the Irish space ghost from the Let's All Wear Green Irish colony that that happens in season 7.
Right, okay. Well, don't spoil it for me.
But I mean, when you start watching that episode, just stop and go on to the next episode.
Right, fair enough. But it's interesting. Remember, I was talking about the episode that turned me off Next Generation Donkeys years ago, when the Romulans turned up and just said, "We're back," and then they flew off again. That turns out to be the last episode of season 1, and I actually really enjoyed it this time. And I thought, this feels like it might be the episode where the Romulans turn up and say, "Hello, we're back," and fly off again. And it was. But actually, the episode had more going to it than I remembered. So I quite enjoyed it. But a couple of things...
And you know, there was a reason why it didn't quite work. A real-world reason why that episode... Well, you
mentioned before that it was the writer's strike or something. So it was all a bit of a problem in obviously getting the scripts together.
So I think there was going to be a sort of Romulan arc that never happened. Basically.
But actually, it didn't feel... Having watched it this time, it felt fine. It didn't bother me in the slightest. It's quite interesting, though. Having watched that season, you know, the Next Generation or the Federation is supposed to be this fabulous example of sort of liberal utopia. But actually, it's feels very much like a kind of racist, human-centric, you know, you never get a captain who isn't human. So, you know, it feels a bit racist in that sense. And also, it feels like it's a bit of a fascist autocracy. So there's an episode where Data, they find the other Data and they fire him up.
Oh, Law, or whatever.
Law, that's the one, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they are, you know, they think that Law is under control, but actually he's swapped with Data, so he's running around doing bad stuff on the ship. And they're on the bridge, and Riker just says, "Tell me where Data is and exactly what he's doing." And they press a couple of buttons, and it's like, "Oh yeah, Data's in the bathroom having a shit or something," you know. And it's just like, hang on, this is a total surveillance society. You know, you can't do anything without knowing.
There is no privacy.
You know, so actually maybe it's not such a liberal utopia as people seem to think. Anyway, that's an enormous aside. The point about that is that having watched Next Generation, it got me really into Star Trek again. And I decided that, because I'd bought Star Trek Adventures on PDF and I'd read it and didn't like it very much because it just seemed really complicated. I thought, well, actually, I'd really want to play this. So I emailed Tony and hinted, you know, do you want to run Star Trek on some of our Wednesday evenings down the pub? And I sweetened the pill by saying, look, and if you do, I'll buy you the book. And he went, yeah, I'd love to. And I thought, oh, damn, he'd probably bought the book himself. So I had to buy him the book. And then I bought myself the
book.
Which
edition did you go for? Did you go for the standard or the deluxe edition?
Well, I bought the standard for Tony. I bought the deluxe for me because the artwork on the cover of the standard is just a bit shit.
Isn't it?
And the artwork on the cover of the deluxe, which is the bridge and the dish of the Enterprise, is fabulous. I love that.
Of course, the Enterprise D.
So I shelled out the extra 15 or 20 quid largely on the basis of that picture, which is seems a bit kind of a bit extravagant, but but it's done now.
But I can't talk about extravagance.
So anyway, we had our character generation session last night down the pub with four of the players who are going to play. We hope that a couple of others would join us as well, but they couldn't make it yesterday. And it was brilliant. I had a great time. And I've rolled up a character that I just cannot wait to play. And I've rolled
up. So let's. We ought to keep this discussion short, but I'm really intrigued by this. Are you playing? Are you playing in the '60s Trek or in Next Generation space?
No, we're playing Next Generation.
Mm-hmm.
Which is all of our preference, actually. Although none of us are really, really big Trekkies, but a couple of us, Dean and Connor, haven't ever really watched Star Trek. But yeah, Next Generation.
And what's the crew like? Who have you got?
So the captain, which is me. Called Matsumoto.
That doesn't surprise me.
Matsumoto Sulu. I am the grandson of Sulu from Star Trek. My father was a complete and utter failure. Didn't even get into Starfleet. So in the game, you get values. And these are kind of role-playing hooks. And my first one is live up to my grandfather's spirit. So I'm trying to sort of get past the shame of my father and live up to Hikaru Sulu's example. But I'm captain of the ship. We decided in the end to go for an Excelsior class. And then we decided, actually, why not have it as the refitted Excelsior? So we're now, nice. I'm now captain of the refitted USS Excelsior, which was Sulu's ship. And one of the one of the traits we put for that ship was a Sulu in command, which again is kind of, you know, the traits in the game in this sense, I'm not entirely sure what mechanical effect they have actually on the way the game plays, but they are... things that will bear upon the ship both positively and negatively. So the traits for the ship are Federation ship. So you get, you know, the pluses and minuses for just being a Federation ship, I guess. Long serving. So the ship will have kind of a proud name, but also the negative might be that bad guys out there might target it as an example.
Yeah.
And then the third trait we've got is, you know, a Sulu in command. So it's kind of the family history that, you know, a Sulu in command of the Excelsior is kind of the right thing to do, which I thought was really cool. The other crew members, we have a half human, half Klingon as our security officer, not called Worf, but you know, but that's cool.
B'Elanna Torres, you mean? You haven't seen any Voyager, have you?
I have seen a bit of Voyager, not much, but yeah, I know who Torres is. Yeah. And again, the way the character generation works, it's all very collaborative, and you have to have one of your values has to link to one of the other characters. So mine is uphold a Klingon's vow. So in the character generation, you get career events, and my two career events were death of a friend, which we decided was the father of this Klingon. Who's now on board my ship, who's my security officer, and contact with a hostile culture, which I took to be the Borg, and therefore we were at the Battle of Wolf 359, I think it is, when the Federation got its ass kicked by the Borg. And that in that battle...
You got your ass kicked by Locutus of Borg.
That's Picard, isn't it? Or
yes.
Something to do with that. Anyway, don't tell me, because I haven't got to that in the season yet. Although I've vaguely got an idea. Anyway, so that drew our characters together really well, which is quite good. And he's got a value which kind of relates. I'm a kind of father, older brother figure to him. The other two, we have a Vulcan science officer, the original, and a Tellarite doctor.
Excellent.
But I absolutely loved the character generation system. It worked really well. It was great fun. I mean, that's all we did yesterday. Had a few beers and rolled up characters and the starship. Didn't even get to play anything, but it was great fun. And we all, I think, are really excited to play the game. So we're not going to play for another month now, because we've got two Coriolis games to come and Easter in the way. But I can't wait to play it. Really excited about the game. And I'd been a bit down on it when I spoke on the podcast a few episodes ago on the level of complexity it felt like in the game, and it just seemed a bit much. having read it again, having talked to a mate at work, having chatted with Tony about it, it's all beginning to become clear. That fog of confusion is beginning to blow away. And I'm really looking forward to playing it. I'm really quite excited, actually, about giving it a go.
So I can't remember whether we talked on the podcast or I mentioned to you some weeks ago in person that I'd played Conan,
yeah. I think it was in person, wasn't it? I don't think we spoke about it on the cast.
And so that uses the same 2D20 rule system, or a version of it, I imagine, subtly changed to fit. Well, I would argue not subtly changed enough to fit the story.
No.
All the time that we were playing Conan, I was sort of taken out of the diegesis of the game by the mechanics. So the mechanics seemed to overwhelm the game in a way that didn't make me feel like a barbarian in ancient Sumeria or wherever it was we were.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I thought, I can see how these would work really well for Star Trek. So I'm not necessarily a massive fan of the mechanics yet, but I do think it would work really well for a crew of technocrats, effectively.
Yeah.
Be they humanist, fascist technocrats or otherwise. I'll leave that to your imagination. Although
it's interesting, in our group yesterday, we've got Dean, Connor and Pete with the other three players there who are obviously all playing in the Coriolis campaign. And they haven't quite got the idea of Star Trek. They're kind of coming to it with a Coriolis kind of attitude. So it's like, guys, there's a chain of command here and we're all working together. And, you know, we're friendly, nice guys. We're the good guys. We're not the bad guys in this one. So it'll be interesting to see how long it takes for them to get that idea. I did have to remind them that we're role-playing here.
I think that's always been a challenge. I remember our old, you know, we used to play FASA Star Trek.
Yes.
And I seem to remember that we didn't want to be really in the proper Starfleet.
No.
And I think there's a, you know, they call D&D players murder hobos. And I think obeying the rules is something that
doesn't come naturally to us.
Let's say
it should
be a new experience, maybe.
Well, that was why I remember with the FASA Star Trek, when I got the Klingon supplement, I ran a Klingon campaign because it basically gave you a lot more latitude to play to your natural personality defaults, which is you know, being a bit
in
chaotic
the Klingon
and evil.
Campaign, the chain of command is the chain I hit you with when you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
To foreshadow some quotes.
Yes. Well, I think that's probably enough on the world of gaming. Let's get on to some Coriolis stuff.
Yeah. Let's talk about my reputation. Not my own personal
reputation. You don't have one, Matthew.
So, I just want to introduce this recorded segment with a little bit of background. This came directly... Well, two things came together. But what really prompted these two recorded elements that I'm going to be talking about now and in a little while after we've talked about the Nomad Federation came out of reading about the Nomad Federation.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a problem with reputation, and I've long been tinkering in the back of my mind with what I do to fix it. And actually, it was doing the research for the Nomad Federation that made it all suddenly seem so clear. So that's what I want to say. But let's start off with my problems with reputation. What do you think is the worst rule in Coriolis? It's an elegant system, and frankly, I don't think there's much wrong with it, but I do have a problem with reputation. And this bit in particular. Your reputation score and that of your opponent will affect your manipulation roll. If yours is higher, you get a +1 for each step you outrank your opponent. If your score is lower, you instead get a -1 for each step of difference. Reputation will, however, only affect your role in situations where your social standing in the Third Horizon is relevant. The GM has the final call on this. What's wrong with this? Well, first of all, it could amount to a massive modifier on manipulation. Reputation for starting characters ranges between 2 and 6 before any modifiers for profession, race if you're humanite, or talents. Play a humanoid soldier, for example, and your reputation is zero. It can't go negative. You could argue that it's perfectly valid for a humanite to be challenged trying to convince a Coriolis council member to change their mind, but most other difficulty modifiers range between -3 to +3. With manipulation, it's feasible to have a negative or positive modifier of 6 dice before the GM starts awarding points for good deeds. And that's another thing. Reputation is only awarded for, and I quote, something generally considered good and heroic. So if you set out to be the most feared pirate in the Horizon, you had better give up any hope of succeeding in a manipulation role. In the forthcoming Forbidden Lands version of the rule set, your reputation can be good or bad. Though it has a similar modifying effect to manipulation, it also works for basic recognition roles. In essence, your reputation does precede you. Which brings me to my main point. Space is big. Even that little bit of it called the Third Horizon. It takes the best part of 12 hours to relay a message from Kua to Dashroom and back, travelling at light speed. And ships don't go that fast. You'd take 3 weeks to fly between those two places. The only way to communicate between systems is via portals, and though it's possible, it's by no means instantaneous, and it is very expensive. Yes, the Bulletin has its network of probes to transmit news, but even so, news travels slowly in the Third Horizon. There are also millions more people than there might be in the Forbidden Lands, and remember, these are systems that have very different cultures, languages, and structures after decades of isolation. My argument being, in the Third Horizon, you will never be as famous as you think you are. So, as GM, I've always seen reputation more as a score of self-respect, self-confidence, than people actually trusting you more because of your good deeds. I might be wrong in this, but if I were to start using reputation as actual renown, it would rarely modify any dice rolls. I even wonder if it isn't an optional rule. I always find it slightly weird, in fact, that the text I read out earlier for using reputation appears as a sidebar on page 62, and not in the body text. After years of reading RPG layouts, I've come to think of sidebars as places for examples or optional rules. I'd have written it off as a layout error, or rather a forced compromise, but perhaps it's intentional. Sidebarred because it should be a rarely used rule. Anyhow, I rarely house rule, but I do house rule this. If there is a difference in reputation, you get a single modification die on your manipulate roll. If the difference is massive, it might be 2, or at the most, 3 dice of modification, but no more than that. Now, if I'm going to use the reputation score on your character sheet as a measure of self-respect and confidence, how am I going to measure how well people know you, speak of you, and trust you? Wait and see.
Really interesting, Matt. Thanks for that. I've got quite a lot, I think, there that I agree with you on. I think I have a problem with reputation as well. And actually, in my games, I haven't used or referred to reputation at all. And I wonder whether the reputation is actually much better suited in Coriolis to a game or a style of game that's much more political or diplomatic than the kind of trader, nomad trader kind of game that we tend to play. So, I do wonder whether, I don't feel like I've lost out for not having used reputation. Maybe the players have a little bit. But I also completely agree that, the extent of potential bonus you would get is enormous. You could get, like you say, +6 dice to a manipulate roll against against a humanite soldier, say, and that seems really quite excessive. So I think
that seems excessive, particularly that those could be 2 starting characters there, and the manipulation role is a thing that, it doesn't say that you can't use it against PC characters. So it feels very old school. I know it's not meant to be mind control,
No. Although
but
I guess...
it does feel that, that two beginning characters coming fresh to the game, particularly if they haven't had much experience about how role-playing games work, you know, if you and I were playing this when we were like, you know, 13 and 14 or whatever, we would, I think, potentially get quite upset by what one of us did to the other one. If one of us was a humanite and the other one was a...
And one was being a bit of a dick, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although I think... I do.
And that's
I do
just
think,
at the beginning. You know, once we start handing out points of good deeds, who knows where it goes?
Yeah. I do think, though, maybe there's a nuance here which perhaps you haven't quite captured, which is, you know, the reputation applies in situations where that reputation would apply. So, for example, a humanite soldier with a, you know, a reputation of zero going up against or being influenced by somebody in his command chain, say he's got an influence of five, you could possibly argue that that might apply, but it would only apply in very situational positions.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't apply, say, if a politician or someone unconnected tried to influence them. So if they had a reputation of five and they tried to influence a humanite soldier, the humanite soldier would be, I think, well within his rights to say, kind of, who are you? Why do I care about your reputation? You could play it that way, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think there are circumstances where, I think there are almost a million to one circumstances where it wouldn't apply, given, you know, everything I said about the size of the horizon.
Yeah.
And I mean.
I do love your phrase where you say, in the third horizon, you'll never be as famous as you think you are. I think that's a really good line.
I'm not that worried by it. And, you know, and it's interesting, actually, that it is sidebarred. So I do wonder whether there is an implicit optionality to that rule.
Yeah.
But at the same time, in the body text, it does say, you know, it will affect your manipulation roles, which then makes it more, but I still have a problem with, you know, potentially plus six when all the other bonuses and modifiers are kind of up to plus or minus three. So I think if I'm doing it, and I was doing this actually when you were actually really successfully manipulating or lying to
Hamza,
woman whose name I've forgotten from the
Hamza, wasn't it?
Hamza, yeah.
On Paradise, yeah.
You know, I was giving her a modifier in her reactions to that, based on, you know, what she thought of your reputation. But even then, you still managed to convince her. So,
So I think there's definitely a situational thing here about where and when you apply it or allow it to apply. But I think, yes, capping it at plus three dice is probably a good idea as well. The other thing I thought that came out of, that struck me from your essay there was the point around game-enforced morality. So you're talking about reputation being awarded just for something that's considered good or heroic. I kind of rebel a little bit against games that try and impose a morality in the mechanics of the game. So, I mean, you bring out the point that, you know, you might want to be, you know, the most feared pirate. Why would that, you know, your reputation is your reputation. It's not positive reputation. It's just reputation. So I think there's definitely something in that you should be able to earn reputation points. That people would then, you know, if you had enough of them, would hear your name and be terrified that it's, oh my God, it's, you know, Bobby the Black Pirate or something. And that would still give you a bonus to your manipulate because they're terrified of you.
It seems to work so much better in Forbidden World, in the Forbidden Lands, for that very reason.
Mm.
You know, if we look at those rules there, then, you know, it explicitly states you get reputation for good or bad things you do.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, if your reputation is based on you being a bastard, then, you know, your name will be known in that smaller, more compact, less populated world. And your reputation will precede you, and potentially people will react to you differently because of that reputation thing.
I think also, talking about game-enforced morality, when I first read the Forbidden Lands rules where they talk about you take damage to yourself. I can't remember how it's expressed, doubt or something. If you murder, if you kill somebody, if you finish somebody off. When I first thought that, you know, my back got up a little bit, and I thought, well, hang on. If I want to play a character that you know, is it like that and could kill people, then I want to play a character like that. You know, don't tell me that I can't. But then thinking about it, I thought, well, actually, that's probably a good thing, because most people, unless you take the talent that allows you to be merciless in the game, most people would probably find it pretty damn hard to finish off somebody, even if you've been fighting them.
Because actually, that isn't about morality. That's about a visceral reaction to killing.
Exactly.
Somebody.
Yeah. So yeah, you know,
a whole
agree.
Bunch of people have a visceral reaction to, you know, to killing a chicken before they're going to eat it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. I mean, how many people could actually kill, you know, a chicken or an animal? You know, if you ran over a fox in your car and it was dying, how easy would you find it to go out and finish him off? Which would probably be the, you know, the kindest thing under the circumstances. You'd find it very difficult, I would argue.
I think, but as you say, there is a way of not having that. You know, if you want to be your merciless killer, you can do that. Just take that as one of your talents.
Exactly.
And I think that, you know, that works really well in that game. In a way, the interesting thing about the morality, I do agree that there's a game enforced morality in the Coriolis by saying that your reputation is based only on your good and heroic deeds, which I don't really like. And it makes me think, in a way, actually, are they hinting that this isn't about reputation? It's more about, you know, you and I play L5R, and there's your honour stat there.
Yes, and about your own self-respect.
Is it more about your honour? And then does it fit into... And I don't want to be... I feel I'm about to be dreadfully orientalist about this, but you know, one thinks about the media one has seen of Tuareg and Arab participants in antagonists and friends of our heroic white Europeans that are actually the centre of the film, and there's a lot of honour being exchanged there, and you know, I will, you are my enemy, but I will still serve you tea because it is my honour. That I won't be rude to you. You know, I want to prove I'm better than you by not being rude to you. I will kill you as soon as your back is turned.
But because I'm a better sort than you. Yeah, I behave better than you as well. Yeah.
So in a way, I feel it's probably what they're aiming for with the reputation, the way they were thinking about reputation in Coriolis was possibly a bit more like honour, but I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe. Anyway, excellent bit of work, Matthew. What a good one. I look forward to listening to the Oasis piece a bit later on. But before that, you have an outstanding question from me from last time to tell us a little bit about the Nomad Federation.
Yes. Now, you remember you weren't all that impressed when I gave you the homework on trade and then you got really into it?
Yes.
Well, I wasn't not impressed with the Nomad Federation, but I am surprisingly more into the Nomads than I thought I would become.
Yeah.
And I want to kick off by, you know, we've talked a lot about the factions in the game. What's your impressions of the Nomad Federation? Where do they stand in your top 10 factions in Coriolis?
Well, I think the very fact that I didn't sort of fully and in detail read the Nomad Federation pages in the Coriolis book until yesterday might indicate where they stand in my top 10, which is not very high. I think there's so much content and background and setting in the book that I've overlooked quite a lot of it, because in my games I've focused on particular things. And so, actually, I hadn't really focused very much on the Nomad Federation at all, which, again, I guess is also, you know, indicated by how little I referred to them in the work I did around trade in the Horizon. Although, I mean, having said that, quite a lot of the stuff I said in that in that piece does actually marry up quite well with what the Nomad Federation background talks about around things like the disputes within the Quadrant of the Pillar, for example, and the Nomad Federation having some control there. So I've kind of, maybe I've sort of inadvertently, unconsciously absorbed some of that in my first reading of the book, or maybe I've just been a bit lucky and, you know, my ideas actually happen to marry up with some of the ideas that are in the book about the Nomad Federation. So to answer your question, not very high in my top 10, because I think I've been focusing on other parts of the background to feed the Spectral Corsair campaign.
Yeah, now you see, I think your reaction would be the same. I mean, it'd be interesting to put a call out. Is there anybody out there actually who, you know, when they read the book, they went, Nomad Federation, that's what we're all about. Let's create our Nomad Federation crew of traders or soldiers or whatever and do that. If there is anybody that said that and thought that this is a faction that I want to work with more than, say, you know, the Zelossians. We've done a lot of stuff about the Order of the Martyr, both in character generation in my campaign and, you know, in your campaign as well. And the Draconites seem to be really popular. If people want to be traders, then they're choosing the Free League, I think, more than anywhere else. So if anybody actually, when they first read the book, leapt upon the Nomad Federation as the go-to faction, then I'd like to hear from you. Drop a comment in any of our social media. But I bet you very few of our listeners have.
I think they all have
the same reaction as you.
Well, I think some of the reason for that might be that the Nomad Federation as a faction is actually very similar in many respects to the Syndicate that we talked about. That it's a very disparate, very broad and spread out faction of multiple mini factions, you know, lots of families, clans, tribes, all kind of doing their own thing. And so they don't really feel like a sort of mega corporation or mega ideological society like the Zelossians or the Consortium or the Legion, which actually then might be easier to grasp. It might grab your attention earlier.
Yeah.
I think, in fact, I'd argue
that it's the Nomad Federation are presented like that, where the Syndicate isn't. They try and present the Syndicate more as a, you know, as a great big behemoth, whereas that everything they say about the Nomad Federation is these people aren't really a federation. They're only just joining in the history of the Third Horizon. They're only just starting to come together.
Yeah.
They are a bunch of warring clans.
But, although they do still center around one representative who's trying to get a seat on the council, and that one representative, this might sound a bit critical, it feels a bit like a cop-out, and I think we probably mentioned this a little bit when we talked about the Syndicate, that actually the Syndicate and the Nomad Federation are so disparate, and deliberately so, which is great. I think that's really good. In the space of two or three pages in the book, it's probably impossible to articulate or bring out in any kind of sensible way that diversity within them. And it's very easy, I think, as a sort of game writer, to fall on something that draws it all together and then makes it feel like a one entity rather than the multiple entities that it actually is. So I do wonder, like you say, the Syndicate feeling like it's a behemoth and the Nomad Federation with one representative at the council trying to be on the council. I think what would make much more sense, much more fun as well, would be maybe there's six or five Nomad Federation potential representatives who are on Coriolis vying with one another to be the one that gets on the council. That would be a really interesting campaign to run. And then you could run it almost completely within the Nomad Federation, you know, as your wide range of diverse competing interests and influences.
And this is kind of the point I want to make. A bit earlier on, you said, oh, but actually the stuff I was thinking about for the Quadrant of the Pillar fits really well with the Nomad Federation. And I think, yes, it does. And I think almost that this is what the Nomad Federation is designed for. So, you know, if you... I think a lot of people, if they're playing mercenary characters, will say, okay, what is our relationship with the Legion? Because they're the big mercenary unit, the mercenary faction. But actually, the Nomad Federation are probably more warlike, and they're involved in more fighting and are having more wars even amongst themselves than the Legion. So, you know, if you want to be an ex-warrior, then the Nomad, you know, the Nomad Clan Warrior is something that that you should consider being. Mm. And the beauty of them being so disparate is actually you can almost do the whole Third Horizon in miniature within the Nomad Federation and have all sorts of factions of your own making as a GM or as a player, having their own politics without worrying at all about the politics that's going on in the wider Third Horizon.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, we're seeing a lot of people going, now that the Emissary Lost campaign and the Mercy of the Icons campaign is looking to be two or three big books delivered over, you know, a number of years, a lot of people are going, oh, you know, I'm suddenly worried that something I'm inventing will be overruled by some invention of a future book. Whereas I think you can invent all that stuff in the Nomad Federation and get away with it because they are so many factions. And I think, you know, you could well do a brilliant political campaign, just as you've discussed, about, okay, finally a seat for the Nomads is granted, but why should it go to the guy that's been asking for it? Actually, the Nomad Federation, you know, then send a whole bunch of different people saying they should be part of the, you know, that they should be the representative of the Nomads.
Yeah.
And there could be all sorts of conflicts and stuff going on there.
And I think that would be really good. I mean, a couple of things that came to mind. I mean, one, you know, they talk about the Nomad Federation having more ships than the Legion, than anybody else, but that a lot of these ships are non-combat ships. They're, you know, they're, people live on them, they're colony ships, they're transport ships. So it really struck me that this is going to sound like a bit of a digression, but bear with me. So one of my favorite books of all time is called The First Man in Rome, written by Colleen McCulloch, and it tells the story of the Roman Republic shortly before it sort of collapsed, and then mm-hmm. you got Caesar and all the rest of it. The story starts maybe 50 years before Caesar comes on the scene. And one of the great things that the Roman Republic at that point had to face was the migrating German tribes. And I immediately thought, when I read about the Nomads and it's all the warriors and the families and everything all together, that had a real parallel to these German tribes who were migrating, who were basically nomads and just moving around trying to find land to live. And it made me think that, you know, is there a really interesting parallel here, that one of the risks, one of the real problems that the Consortium and the rest of the Horizon faces is that one person should emerge and then unite all the Nomad Federation in one really strong body, because then they'll be much more powerful. So there will be lots of scenarios or campaigns you could run about keeping the Nomad Federation clans and tribes divided from one another, or have one that does start to bring them together. And then what does that do for the rest of the Horizon? So it's a really interesting idea.
I mean, I think the beauty of this is that you could prototype this even within the space of the Kua system itself. So the Rimwood Weech,
the Wimwood Weech,
the Wimwood Weech suddenly turned into Jonathan Ross. The Rimward Reach.
Diction, dear boy, diction.
Is an area. I think your players started out there, didn't they?
Their patron lives there. They haven't been there yet, I don't think. But their patron comes from Jakrum in the Rimwood Reach. In the Rim Ward Reach. Yes.
Yeah, so Dash Room is, I think, a really interesting place. It's not a nomad place, but you get the impression there's a whole bunch of nomads round the Rimwood Reach. And even there, they're not united. So these aren't the nomads of the Rimwood Reach. There are three nomad swarms, as they call them. So a swarm is how they define themselves. And I think that's kind of interesting in that they kind of all work together, but they're all doing their other stuff. And so on the Rimwood Reach, we've got three different clans of nomad. We've got the Metar, who are heavily militaristic. We've got the Badjaw, who are, I think, kind of more intelligence and subterfuge based. We've got the Yahin Kabu, who are traders. There's also mention of a lost swarm, the Ahila, who were early combatants in the Marab conflict, where, broadly speaking, prospectors, backed, I'm sure, by the consortium, started mining asteroids that the nomads felt were holy places. And I'm pretty sure that the Ahila were first in there defending the asteroids, and probably with the help of the Legion, quickly defeated. But, you know, so they're there just in that space. You've got three clans all vying to kind of probably unite themselves, but they all, you know, leaders of those three clans want to be the leader of the united Rimwood Reach force.
Yeah.
I think, and it's, you know, like,
sorry, if you kind of take the top off, you know, the idea of some of these factions, and I think, you know, the Syndicate is another really good example. The sort of campaign or scenario ideas, okay, not limitless, but there's tons of them. You know, you're just kind of limited by your imagination.
Yeah, I think there is. And also, you know, if you're struggling to find a place for your scenario idea, if you're going, well, here's a thing I want to explore, but I don't know how it fits in with all these factions, well, I can tell you it will fit somewhere in the Nomad Federation.
Yes.
The beauty of it there is you can really put it in there, and if you want to expand it and have its impact on the Legion and the Consortium and stuff like that, then go ahead, but do it on a small scale first. It for me, I talk about the factions being these great big wheels that really crush player characters under them, rather than player characters being political players. That's kind of the way I think of things. But if you want to be political players, then your characters being political players within the Nomad Federation is a brilliant opportunity, I think.
Yeah, I think it is.
Because there's a real sense, you know, you could be the crew that finally unites half of the Nomad Federation into some sort of force, a political force to be reckoned with, or military force to be reckoned with. You could do that and still not necessarily affect any of the other factions or what else is going on in a big meta campaign, whatever you're doing. And you could get real, real sense of enjoyment there.
It's true. I mean, because you've got all the emissary stuff that's already in the book, even before you get the new campaign coming out. And I haven't referred to the emissary whatsoever in my Spectral Corsair campaign. It's just not been a factor. It's been something, I'm not even sure the players are aware of it. So it's something that is so irrelevant to their daily lives that it's not been a factor in the campaign whatsoever.
No, but you've got if you want to do space monsters, then you can do space monsters again just in the Rimwood Reach. And the fact that just a tiny proportion of the nomads from one tiny place not far from Coriolis. Well, as I've said, actually about 2 or 3 weeks travel from Coriolis, but that's
by the way.
That's not far in the scope of things.
And no, exactly.
They, you know, they've got... there's a creature out in the Rimwood Reach, some darkness between the stars, that many space nomads worship, called Bar Jin. or he's got other names like Urubos, Uruboros, the World Eater, the Star Dragon, and it's said that they, you know, that actually the Nomads can control him, and you could create a whole adventure about, well let's control him and let's get him to defeat the Legion, who are currently blockading the what's it called? There's the Armada of the First Come, which is also right. hanging out around there. There are all these ships that nobody can get into, and the Legion are obviously worried that you know, they present a quite sizable navy if they do come back to life. Well, you know, you could take your players to make those come back to life, to use the monster to defeat the Legion, and then take control of one of these ships or all of them, and yeah, they're great. I'm just really loving.
Yeah. Okay. Should I expect that Yaphet and Salar and Salem will be going to the Rimwood Reach at some point in the near future?
Well, I tell you what, I really, you know, I said I regretted hand waving that journey over to Mira.
Yeah.
I kind of really, really wish it had been to somewhere like the Rimwood Reach and you hadn't even gone through a portal.
Yeah.
You know, I think we tend to think space travel equals portal travel. And well, I definitely kind of thought that, and I think that was my mistake. I think we could, you could keep the whole campaign within the Kua system and have spaceships flying and things like that and still have fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I just want to get on to how liberal the Nomad Federation are. So,
how liberal are they then, Matthew?
Sorry?
How liberal are they then?
I think they're quite liberal. I think I'm reading this right. So, for a start, if you want to do body modification, generally frowned upon in most of civilization, but not among the Nomads. So there's particularly a place called Ahalim, which is where Nomads go for biocoding. But across the Rimwood Reach, you've got Nomads who've given themselves prehensile tails and things like that to help them get around in zero gravity. And just trying to find, I've got a reference to this somewhere in my notes, that it struck me that there is this, we talked about the reputation that you get when you're a humanite, that people hardly think humanites are human. I think it was the Nomads who are prepared to be more liberal about humanites, and I'm just going to, I can't find it, let me just...
Okay, well, you could quite easily argue that there are whole Nomad Federation clans or factions, you know, factions within the faction that are humanites because they you know, live in space and you know, they've been modified to be more effective in zero G, say, or more resilient to radiation or whatever. So I think that makes a lot of sense.
No, I agree entirely. I think these are guys who are willing to be humanite, you know, and to treat humanites as brothers. For example, the Berry Nomads living in Lubao, I think they're probably likely to be humanites. Oh God, I'm just trying to find a thing. I wrote this down and I can't find it. So here we go. So this is from page 241. And I'm just going to swing to it because I didn't take a full note. I only made a page reference.
Okay.
So, I'm going to read from the book. In the past few cycles, a new subject has sparked debate among philosophers and preachers, especially in the Rimwood Reach and the Kua system. The matter concerns whether or not humanites are the spiritual equals of base humans. The issue was first brought up when new colonists questioned the Nomads' religious rhetoric. The prophet Ndina addressed the issue in a sermon, and the five head preachers in the Rimwood Reach were quick to outline new teachings for the Najim, the humanites. An ecumenical assembly. I'm not going to say those words out.
Oikumene as Najim.
Yes. is being organized to establish that there is no spiritual difference between humanites and base humans. And so I'm seeing this is the bit that made me think that actually the humanites are the more liberal gang.
The nomads. Yeah.
The nomads, sorry, yeah. That they've been working with humanites for years, and then these prospectors come in and kind of go, ooh, you're treating humanites as brothers and equals. And then they say, well,
can't be having that. Yeah.
And we said we think we can, and we're going to actually formalize that relationship. So but of course, being nomads, not everybody agrees.
No.
And so I think there's so much scope for different levels of thought. And as you say, you could invent a whole bunch of stuff for an area of space, and then when it comes to it, you can go, oh yeah, and I can, and that's all a bit different from what we've learned from subsequent books in the series, because these guys are actually nomads. So
excellent.
These are almost now my go-to faction if I want to be thinking about these guys. Can be criminals, they can be soldiers, they can be mystics, they can be religious, whatever sort of campaign you want to run. I think the Nomad Federation give you great scope for doing stuff.
Cool. Well, thanks for that, Matthew. I mean, that was a really good conclusion to an interesting conversation, recognizing that we are banging on quite a bit. So I think we can, having referred to reputation, I think let's listen to the rest of your essay about oases and reputation in that context.
Yeah, and I will say that this is what really cemented it. Reading about the humanites again brought me back to the station in the Rimrod Reach called, I think we pronounce it differently, but then we're different parts of the Nomad Federation. I pronounce it Jashroom, and you pronounce it slightly differently.
Jackroom.
If you can tell the difference between the two. Well, we're both right, because
you've just got more. All it is you've just got more phlegm in your throat when you say it. That's all.
Exactly. Yes. and I realised that I've been trying to sort of formalise how I think about a place that people might call, crews might get to know as their refuge, and we discussed it with the gang, and Costa said, of course, we should be calling these oases, and is entirely right. So this is my first thoughts on oases. Earlier on, I explained how I'm going to use the reputation score on your character sheet as a measure of self-respect and confidence. So, how am I going to measure how well people know you, speak of you, and trust you? Well, I think that's more local and based not on word of your good deeds spreading across the horizon, but rather on the places you go and the people you deal with. There have been some suggestions that perhaps you might earn different reputations with different factions. But I disagree. Factions, like space, are too big to care about the little people. The faction standing talent is, I think, the only mechanic we need to reflect characters that have some influence in a faction. So instead, I offer this. If you visit a place more than once, you might begin to consider it a safe port or oasis, a place to retreat to lick your wounds, repair your ship, and fence your stolen artifacts. And that's when you start measuring your relationships in that local community. Each oasis will offer one or more services. Right now, I'm thinking the list includes ship service and repair, prayer, brokerage, security, traders, counselling, by which I mean treatment of mind points, and medicurgy. But I'd be interested in hearing any others that people might suggest. There may also be a separate administration. So, for example, your oasis might be Samar's Hammam. Although it's a small location, and ostensibly a bathhouse, which would probably count as counselling, a crew might also use it for brokerage there. Or your oasis might be Jashroom, the asteroid station on Kua's Rimwood Reach, where pretty much every service is on offer. On Jashroom, the administration is the enigmatic Akbar, but at Samar's, it's of course the boss, Samar herself. Here, the administration and the main service, counselling, are one and the same. The brokerage service at Sir Mars is actually another regular customer. Let's call him Bardas. On Jashroom, the services might be provided by named individuals or, more probably, organisations. For example, the Samaritans will be the main providers of Medicurgy. It's possible for your crew to have a relationship with those organisations without having to name an individual, but your relationship is only at a local level. Having a good relationship with the Samaritans on Jashroom does not mean you can expect the same welcome when you visit them on Coriolis. Just as the Samaritans are an extension of the Order of the Pariah, other service providers might also have a relationship with a faction. Our broker friend, Bardas, might be connected with the Nomad Federation, for example, but they don't need to have such an allegiance. The Akbar of Jashroom is famously independent. To track your relationship, I'm thinking about a very simple scale with 0, 1 or 2 dice modifiers. Your relationship starts at 0, you're just another customer. But there are two ways to earn positive dice. Do a favour or a job of work for them and you get a 1 die bonus. As Niska said in Firefly, your reputation is solid. Or spend 5 experience points to claim a personal relationship with the organisation and get another bonus die. The GM characters created with the Friend in Every Port talent don't get the bonus die unless you also spend 5 XP. It's possible to get both bonus dice, but 2 is the absolute maximum. You can't pay, say, 10 experience points or do 2 jobs to get 2 dice. You must earn 1 with each method. Of course, you can make an enemy of any of these providers, wrong them, or screw up the job they gave you, and you'll get a negative modifier on future dealing with them. Punish them for that slight. I know what players are like. And the modifier is -2 dice. It's hard to recover those negative dice. Just ask Sergei Skripal, or Niska's wife's nephew. But each job you successfully do for them will help you get back to a 0 modifier. I think, though, that once you've had negative bonuses, you can never earn a positive die with them. I'm putting together an Oasis record sheet to help the GM keep track of these relationships. Right now, I'm thinking that each crew might only have 1 Oasis. But given that the sheet I'm designing currently fits more than one, I might change my mind. Either way, when I've completed it, I'll share it on my blog.
I've got a few thoughts coming out of that, but on the whole, I like what you're talking about there, Matthew. I think, the idea of an oasis or numerous oases is a really good one, and the way you've talked about it, the way you've sort of brought it out, I think is excellent. So, I had a couple of thoughts though. You talk about the services that an oasis might be able to offer, and I think there's maybe a couple more that you could add to that list.
Sure there are. So what are your suggestions?
Well, although I think these both might be the same. So I thought they can offer protection or they can offer sanctuary. So if you are a good friend, then you can go to these places to lie low for a while, maybe, and they will help you do that. Thinking around, Firefly, you got Shepherd Book and Haven as the place where they might run to.
Yes.
You've got others, like Li Chen in Whitefall and the Sanchez brothers in Boros, who end up getting killed because they are exactly places where they would run to after a heist. So I think, protection is something that you might be able to offer as well, rather than just a quite transactional kind of
service. I was thinking very specifically about places like Haven, which of course fans of Firefly will recognise, not from the TV series, but from
Serenity,
the film Serenity, where it's where Shepherd Book hangs out. And in fact,
it's not such a haven because that's where he gets killed as well. Sorry,
that's
spoilers.
Where Shepherd Book gets
people
killed.
People haven't watched it.
The operative finds out where all their, let's call them oases, are the Firefly crew's oases, and burns every one of them to flush the crew And particularly, of course, Summer Glau's, what's her name?
River.
Yeah, I've forgotten her name. River, the person is specifically hunting out. So that was in my mind. And I guess what I was thinking about that is, it's an interesting point. I was thinking the administration would be the person that you'd befriend. So, you know, if you want to seek refuge on Jashroom, then you want to have a dice with the Akbar himself, and you've got his personal protection.
I'm not sure I agree, because I think Jashroom is going to be huge. You know, it's a very big space station. There's probably thousands of people there. So I think the Oasis idea, as you've described it, and you know, as you specifically describe it in your piece, could be as small as, you know, Samar's Hammam, or it could be somewhere as big as Jashroom. But I still think you would probably have, a key contact or a key friend, so Shepherd Bush on Haven, for example. But I don't think for Jashroom that would have to be the Akbar. That could be a patron. It could be some other reasonably influential figure, of whom there will be loads on a place.
Now, I'm not
the
saying
size
you're wrong. I'm saying that's where
Jashroom.
I was thinking in terms of the administration. But you're right. It could well be any of the characters that offers you some form of protection.
Yeah, I also think that where you say at the end that you sort of think that the crew should only have one Oasis, but you're in two minds about it. I think you're wrong. I think you should be able to have as many Oases as you spend the time and effort to develop. So I think actually having your Oasis list that you're going to put together, or your Oasis sheet, should allow you to have more than one Oasis, particularly if you're a trader or you're around the horizon. You know, you're going to find places of refuge all over the place, aren't you? You're not going to be stuck with one that's, you know, Jashroom in the Windward Reach. I'm going to call it the Windward Reach from now on, because I keep saying it that way anyway.
The Windward Reach.
So Jashroom in the Windward Reach is a long way away from everything else, isn't it? So it's a place you wouldn't get back to very often. So I think having more than one Oasis would be entirely appropriate and sensible.
And in fact, actually, a key point that I'm reminded of is that one of the reasons why Costa explained that they didn't do something like the arcs from Mutant Year Zero in Coriolis is because people would be travelling and wouldn't be returning to the arc every night, or however often they return to the arc normally. So,
and this is
right,
this is kind of arc light, isn't it? So you have lots of little arcs, but none that are actually of the same scale as you would get in Mutant Year Zero.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I was looking for a simpler system, but in a way, I think you could sort of build arcs. So if you had a community like Haven, and you wanted to add a service there, you know, there could be a whole adventure in acquiring whatever equipment and was needed for that service, and
I agree,
recruiting somebody to actually provide it, as it were.
I think that's a really good idea.
So you could do arc building in the in a way a bit like Mutant Year Zero,
but in a different sense. Yeah, I like that. I think that's good. I also think that the way you talk about developing your dice is good. My one concern is you talk about spending 5 experience points to gain one of your bonus dice that would be available in any particular Oasis. I just wonder, is that too expensive to encourage players to actually purchase, you know, a dice of, you know, on an Oasis with 5 experience? So maybe the dice should be a reward for some particular good bit of role playing instead, or if the players like you say, do something in role playing terms to develop or protect or help the base. maybe they get a dice in that sense rather than spending 5 XP, because that's quite a lot of XP to spend
on
a location that you're not going to come back to very often. I just wonder whether players would be disencouraged from spending points on it. Because
I think I'm trying to disencourage them to spend points.
Because they would have higher priorities to spend their XP.
Yeah, I think they might. I think the easy way to get a dice bonus is to do a job.
Yeah.
You know, do something for the client. And I think, you know, I wanted to have one dice that was kind of an easy reward for, you know, but a definite reward. Because I often think sometimes, why are we doing this?
Mm.
Why are we doing this job for this patron? It's kind of only for the money.
Yes.
So I wanted to say that there was something other than money that might motivate you to do a job for a patient, or a reward, a recognition of having done a job well, some sort of recognition that future dealings might advantage you a bit. So that's the one that I think most people will go for. I did think that five experience points from one crew member is a sacrifice for that crew member, but it is a crew. It's a sacrifice that benefits the whole crew.
Yeah, maybe. I kind of get that. I do wonder, actually, just thinking, maybe the scale should be up to three dice, and you get one dice, your first dice, you get for doing a job, a mission for them. Yeah. You can then, the second dice is available for doing something that, in role-playing terms, significantly helps that place, like you say, providing you know, another service, or I don't know, donating lots of money so they don't starve or something. And the third one could be your 5 XP to give you plus 3 dice. So you've got kind of a scale of different level of commitment to the group.
I did wonder about 3. In the end, I decided against it, but I'll think about it some more.
So I guess the other question is, how do those dice work in the game?
I'm thinking that this comes down, this is kind of an alternative to your manipulate, or actually kind of an alternative to manipulate, but I think it might affect other skills. So, you know, if you're going for let's say the counselling service, you want to recover your mind points. Then no, let's not say that. Let's go for something that's got a proper recovery mechanic to it. Somebody's offering you medical experience, then if you've earned 2 bonus dice with them, it's not about, you know, paying their doctor's bills. It's an extra bonus dice on effectively what they're rolling for your treatment.
On the actual roll.
Yeah.
Because they like you, and therefore they're throwing all their resources to help you, rather than just doing it as a 5-minute round the back kind of. Oh, if I can be bothered, I'll. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I like that.
But if it's a brokerage deal you've got, you know, this is the offence for your stolen artifacts.
Yeah.
Then that is always going to be a haggling role, a manipulation role, and it would be a bonus to you on that one because he likes you really. He's a bit soft on you.
Cool. I like it.
But I think actually it could be worth filling out, thinking a bit more about what each of those services might offer in terms of skill roles, and just make sure that, you know, there is a reason for having a bonus. The reason I stopped talking about counselling is I can't quite remember now how you recover mind points, and it may be you just don't need to roll a dice at all. So
no, I think mind points are quite easy to recover.
Yeah,
I think you just need to sleep or something, and you're okay.
So I think I need to look at all those different services and think, is there one that it's worth having bonus dice on?
But I think the idea of the Oasis, as you described it, is an excellent one. And I'll hurry up and do that Oasis sheet, because I'm going to use it in my campaign.
Cool.
So,
okay.
Excellent.
I'll get that done. Tell me, though, how is your campaign coming on?
Well, we had a bit of a hiatus. We've played one game in the last probably 6 weeks, partly down to availability of people. But in the end, I kind of decided just to run the game anyway after a few false starts. I mean, 2 of the players hadn't been around for a while, so Carter and Mia, so Pete and Morgan were both unavailable for a long while. And so I decided to run the game eventually, and then in the end, Paul couldn't make it either, so I ended up running it with just three. But that worked pretty well. So this episode was called Now Get Out of That. Because if you remember, at the end of the last episode, they just tried to escape from the primitives at the stone ruins on Omran, where they'd been trapped on a ziggurat. And in attempting to escape, they'd crashed, and the Corsair was lying smoking and in a bit of a wreck in the forest a couple of miles away. So the crash took out the ship. It also took out Carter, Mia, and 8-Bit, which was my way of explaining how those characters weren't involved in the scenario because their players weren't there. That worked fine. So those that were left, Hanbal, Osgar, and Norsa, the Nekatra, they assessed the damage. There was multiple hull breaches, the cargo bay was open to the elements, the reactor had automatically shut down and looked like it had no intention of firing up ever again. And perhaps most worryingly, the ship's chapel had been smashed and the altars to the icons had been scattered. So this wasn't the end of their troubles. There were fires taking hold on board the ship, and there were some creatures outside that were trying to get in. Now, these creatures, I called them cavern hags, but they were based on Minox out of Star Wars. So creatures that like to suck on power cables and basically tear a ship apart by just trying to eat the power from it. So they had to fight some of these, which they managed to. They then realized that the only way they were going to get out of this was by reviving 8-Bit. Now, my original plan with the campaign, with the scenario... Sorry, I'll edit this bit out. Just start again. So my original idea with this scenario was that they'd have to go to the wrecked colony ship, Rivius, salvage what they needed from it to repair the Corsair, and then escape, all the while being hassled and harried by the primitives and these beasts. So very much a sort of combat-focused scenario. Without 8-Bit being there, they couldn't do that because they didn't have anybody with technology skill. So I turned the scenario into one of having to revive 8-Bit rather than actually fixing the ship. And then once 8-Bit's revived, he could then fix the ship and they could get away. So they remembered that inside the ziggurat, there was this casket that had been protecting a woman. They opened it and this woman was alive inside it. And they learned through Lena that this is possibly what's known as a chrysalis pod, which is a portal builder artifact, extremely valuable and reputed to have the power to revive people. Funny that. So they decided to fight their way back to the ziggurat to try and get 8-Bit into this pod to see if it would revive him. They managed that, and I'll talk a bit in a moment about one of the things running the game that I sort of took into account that sort of helped that happen. But they got there in the end. They managed to get him in the chrysalis pod. Was it really a porter builder marvel? Well, yes, it was. Yeah, luckily. And 8-Bit was revived, and therefore, I think of getting back to the ship, they could repair and get off the planet. But they were then on the ziggurat again, surrounded by all the primitives. They then decided to push the casket down the edge of the ziggurat and run behind it and use that as a way of scattering the bad guys. Now, this casket obviously could make people well again, exceedingly valuable. I wasn't sure as a GM that I wanted them either to have the money for it or to be able to revive themselves willy-nilly. Yeah. So a couple of darkness points, seeing they decided to shove it off the edge of this stone building. A couple of darkness points see it shatter at the bottom into millions of useless pieces. So it helped them escape, but they lost it in the process, so they weren't able to use it.
That's which is probably a great outcome. How did they feel about that?
They weren't as upset as you might have expected, partly because it did allow them to get a head start on the chase back to the ship, and if they hadn't had that, then chances are they might all have been killed. because earlier in the game they'd been broken by the primitives. So when they left the ship to go to the ziggurat, they were attacked in the woods and they were broken. Luckily for them, the primitives, their motivation wasn't to kill them, it was to put them back in the ziggurat. And that happened to be exactly where they wanted to be. So being broken in the combat actually did them a service, because the natives then carried them to the ziggurat and chucked them in, which is where they wanted to be. But that was, it was an interesting one, because I'd taken a conscious decision to try and pull away from the temptation to go for crits all the time and try and go and be a bit more broken. But then obviously that has narrative outcomes. It can change the direction of a scenario. If someone's broken, then there's obviously a consequence to being broken. In this instance, it was fine because it deposited them there exactly where we wanted them to be for the scenario. But I did have one occasion. I had one critical hit, which landed on Norsa, the Nicatra, which is Connor's character. And there was a real palpable tension in the air when he rolled the dice. I mean, he was... he'd played Valdez, who'd been killed with a bad critical dice roll. And I was just thinking, oh no, don't kill him, don't kill him, don't kill him. But, you know, the dice came up and it didn't. You know, it was a minor critical. But still, I think as a GM, there's a lesson to be learned around how often do you place your players in that life or death tension moment of rolling the critical dice to see whether they live or die. And I don't think you can do it too often, actually. I think you need to do it once in a while, but you shouldn't be doing it three times a game or four times a game. Unless, of course, it's kind of the big finale of the campaign, in which case you might want to make it a bit more threatening in that sense. So anyway, they managed to to escape, got back to the ship, and then were able to repair the ship and get off the planet. So that was the end of the scenario. But one of the things I wanted to mention was there are no rules in the game for chasing or being chased. So I decided that they'd managed to break a hole in the line of natives. So they got a head start. But they had a 2-mile chase through the woods. And rather than try and do it sort of turn by turn, I came up with a dexterity roll to try and recreate the chase. So I kind of remember back in the day, used to play James Bond role-playing game. And that had specific rules for chases, because obviously James Bond films have a lot of chases in them. And so I tried to sort of mimic at least some of the principles of that. So I gave them a 2-success head start, thanks to using the casket to break a hole in the line. And they then rolled opposed roll dexterity against the native's dexterity, and every success took them, increased that gap. And if they got to +5 successes, they were far enough away to disappear in the woods and have escaped the chase. If it came down to +1, then the natives were close enough to throw a spear at them, and they'd get a couple of spears chucked. If it came down to 0, then the natives were on top of them and could tackle them and bring them down. And that seemed to work really well. And that recreated a sort of 2-mile, 10-minute chase in the space of about 6 or 7 rolls. So it worked quite nicely. But I'd be interested to hear your views, others' views on, you know, on a chase mechanic, whether you know, there's something that, you know, the game needs, or whether sort of handling it in the way that I did is perhaps a good sort of on the hoof house rule to try and manage that.
I think chase mechanics are,
but anyway,
can be over complex, and so what you've suggested there works quite well. It makes me think of the chase mechanics in Feng Shui, which kind of are similar.
I don't really remember them. I've never run Feng Shui, only played it with you.
Of course, it makes everything relative, as you did. You know, are they close enough to chuck a spear at you?
Yeah.
Are they close enough to engage you? Are they too far away? And can you get further steps away and then you've lost them, sort of thing? And I think that's kind of the way it should be. And again, it's something similar in Knights Black Agents and, you know, those Gumshoe games, which of course share an author with Feng Shui. So you can see it happening there as well.
In Mutant Year Zero, you have a move skill. And to disengage from a combat, all you need to do is succeed in a roll on that move skill. And then you move sufficiently well to escape the combat, which I thought was a bit too easy to escape. So you're in a combat, you don't like it. Oh, I roll my move. Yeah, fine, I'm safe. Just felt a bit too get out of jail free like to me.
Yeah.
But I think the way it worked, it seemed to work very well in the game, running the chase rules in the way that I chose to run them.
Cool. I'm just trying to think. There's something similar, but we should check out the rules in Forbidden Lands as well, because I think there's a disengage for a move, but of course you've got to have the right. It talks about getting out of. You've got to disengage and also get out of the zone, as it were. We could look into that.
Okay, well, we'll have a look at those and see for next time. But anyway, at the end of the scenario, they manage to get to a planet with a small spaceport, and that's where they are in advance of the next scenario, which is next week, which I'm going to run two over Easter whilst Morgan is back from university, and we'll have a full complement of players. I'm hoping that in those two scenarios, we will resolve this part of the campaign. They will hopefully find Resim and resolve what's been going on all this time. So it'd be good if we can do that.
Them crashed on the planet, how damaged was their ship? Or rather, I'm asking is how did you sort of mechanically deal with the repairs?
Right, I haven't mechanically dealt with the repairs yet. What I did for the damage was I produced a bespoke critical hit table for the Spectre Corsair, and then I rolled on that. Now, my plan had been, if Paul had been available for the game, I was going to roll the damage there and then in front of them. But also have the reactor on meltdown. So the very first thing they had to do was shut the reactor down before the ship would explode, whilst dealing with the fires, whilst dealing with the cavern hags coming through the tears in the hull. But without him being there, and therefore having nobody with a technology skill, I put that bit to one side and just left it with the fires and the creatures, which worked fine. So I had a bespoke table. In the end, the actual amount of damage that the ship's taken was kind of irrelevant. I'll decide before the next scenario what the repairs will look like, how many rolls they need, and how much it's going to cost. But it's going to be expensive, so the ship is pretty badly damaged.
Right.
So they might find that their nice little pot of burr that they've been building up might suddenly be significantly reduced. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because, of course, you guys are prisoners in my campaign, and I'm thinking, how do I deal with that in the next adventure? Because nobody likes being prisoners. Although, maybe an adventure in a prison is fun, but only if it ends with you getting out of prison.
If it ends in a 30-year jail sentence, it might not be such a blast.
And next week, we'll be doing year two.
exactly.
So, I'm thinking prison planet, broadly speaking. And how do you get off the prison planet? Obviously, you're not going to have your ship because you're going to have been taken there in stasis beds and then woken up to some horrible surprise, which I'm still thinking about how horrible I can be. So I'm thinking it may well have the adventure of effectively somehow building your own ship, which I think we can create a way where that might happen.
Interesting.
Or finding a ship.
This is the A-team goes on holiday.
Exactly. or people have been building a ship for generations and you just happen to be there at the time when it's all, you know, where your contribution actually gets the thing working or whatever. So yeah, I'm just really interested in how people get off planets when the ships have been destroyed is a topic that I'm thinking of. Your ship hasn't been destroyed, but it's somewhere else, of course, now. Whether you want to go and find Mukafar again, or whether we say, you know, here's an opportunity to build another ship. Oh, this is fun. We like this new one. I don't know yet. We'll think about that nearer the time, I guess. We've got months before we're playing that again, though, aren't we?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Well, I think we've probably banged on enough for one day. We've probably done. Is this our longest one now? It might be.
This recording is coming up to 2 hours.
1 hour 50.
And we haven't done many retakes, as it were. So it must all be gold.
We've just been blathering on. It has been a month because of my availability. So I guess we've got a lot of stuff to get out there. We just can't stop talking. But unless there's anything else, Matthew.
Well, there's one thing. We appear to be going through the factions at a tremendous rate, and I wonder whether we should look in detail at another faction next time. And
we can do that. It's my turn to research, isn't it?
So,
Kate, which one are you giving me then, Matt?
I thought, thinking about the underrated faction of the Nomad Federation, I wondered whether we ought to explore that faction whose motto is "Every human is a world of its own," and that faction is Alarm's Temple. Do you want to take that on?
Okay. Yeah. I will take that on. Mission accepted. Cool.
We'll find out more than we ever wanted to know about the sex
about them
of Alarm's Temple.
I'll try and limit my research a little bit this time.
Yeah, don't use your imagination too much, because frankly, we don't want to go.
No. Thanks. Right.
Okay.
On that note, I think it's goodbye
from me. Goodbye from me.
And may the icons bless your adventures.
You have been listening to The Coriolis Effect, presented by Fiction Suit with the RPG Gods, with music by Stars on a Black Sea, used with permission of Free League Publishing. Imagery from NASA and the Hubble Space Telescope, brought to you by Wikimedia Commons. Typeface is Code by FontFabric.